the law declared, and take the name Catholic Christians. Meeting places of those who do not believe shall not be given the status of churches, and such people may be subject to both divine and earthly retribution. Theodosius actually believed that he could legislate his subjects into believing only in a Nicene-defined deity. He was a clever politician, but his theological reasoning was often naive. Sozomen, for example, writes that when Theodosius convened a church council the following year, 381, as a follow-up to the issuing of the law, he brought together the presidents of the sects which were flourishing, so that they could discuss their differences, for he imagined that all would be brought to oneness of opinion if a free discussion were entered into, concerning ambiguous points of doctrine. This was wildly optimistic, and as anyone who has ever been involved in church work could predict, it didn't work. But Theodosius soldiered on. Now that his law had been passed, he could start enforcing uniformity on a practical level. He took all of the meeting places and churches of the non-Nicene Christians and handed them over to the Nicene bishops, a material gain for those fortunate priests. He threatened to expel heretics who insisted on preaching from the city of Constantinople and to confiscate their land. He didn't always carry through on these threats. Sozomen remarks, approvingly, that although he had enacted severe punishments for heresy into law, the punishments were often not applied. He had no desire to persecute his subjects. He only desired to enforce uniformity of view about God through the medium of intimidation. Theodosius was finding that it was easier to announce unity than to actually create it. In many ways, the Goths were easier to deal with than heretics. All he had to do was kill them. While he was convening councils and making doctrine, Theodosius was also directing a fight against Gothic invasion. The Goths had become such a problem that Gratian, in the west, had agreed to transfer the most Goth-infested part of his Western Empire, three dioceses in the central province of Pannonia, over to the Eastern Empire, so that Theodosius would be responsible for driving the Goths out. Unfortunately, the army was not quite strong enough to take on this extra task, so Theodosius managed to beef it up with an innovative strategy. He recruited barbarians from some regions to fight against barbarians in other regions. He would hire Goth mercenaries from Pannonia, transfer them over to Egypt, and then bring Roman soldiers from Egypt over to Pannonia to fight other Goths. The definition of Roman soldier, like the definition of Roman, was becoming increasingly nebulous, even while Theodosius managed to make the definition of Christian more restrictive. The thinness of the line between Roman and barbarian became more obvious in 382, when, after 4 years of fighting against the Goths, Theodosius decided that too much energy was going to the war, and made a peace treaty with them instead. The treaty allowed them to exist within the borders of the Roman Empire, under their own king. The Gothic king would be subject to him as emperor, but the Goths themselves would not have to answer to any Roman official. And when they fought for Rome, they would do so as allies, rather than as Roman soldiers in regular Roman army units, subject to regular Roman officers. By 382, Theodosius could claim that he had reduced the chaos in the eastern part of the empire to order. The Christian church was unified, the Goths were at peace, all was right with the world. But all of Theodosius's solutions had the appearance, not the reality, of victory. In fact, the Goths were not subdued. Arianism, not to mention a score of other heresies, was not dead. The Christians of the empire were not united, and even the leadership of Theodosius's newly created Catholic Church was in debate. As part of his church council in 381, Theodosius had announced that the Bishop of Constantinople was equal to the Bishop of Rome in authority, because Constantinople is the new Rome. This law might be on the books, but in 382, even as Theodosius celebrated his victories, the bishops of the older cities, the traditional centers of Christianity, were objecting to the exaltation of the relatively young bishopric in Constantinople. So did the Bishop of Rome, who called his own council in Rome in 382, and announced that the Bishop of Rome was the leader of all other bishops, including the upstart at Constantinople. The churchmen in Rome agreed, and the Bishop of Rome ordered his secretary, a young man named Jerome, to record the decision. The Roman council also agreed that Jerome, who was good with languages, should start working on a new Latin translation of the scriptures. This was a direct response to the attempt to make the Greek-speaking East equal to the West. The Council at Rome had now declared that Latin, the language of the West, was the proper language for scripture, and the proper language for public worship as well. Theodosius had declared all Christians to be one, but the eastern and western halves of his Catholic Church were beginning to pull apart. Part 2. Fractures. Chapter 9. Excommunicated. Between 383 and 392, a Spaniard becomes king of the Britons, and Theodosius discovers that he has underestimated the power of the Church. In 383, the Roman army in Britain rebelled and proclaimed a new emperor, Magnus Maximus, their general. At first, Magnus Maximus possessed only the loyalty of the troops in Britannia. He was, in effect, the king of the Britons, despite being a Roman citizen and a Spaniard by birth. But it seems likely that he had exercised a king-like power in isolated Britannia for some years. His name pops up in Welsh legends, where he is known as Maxen Wledig, a half-legendary figure who stars in the epic Brwydwyd Maxen. In the tale, Maxen Wledig is in Rome, ruling as emperor, when he dreams of a beautiful maiden who must become his wife. He searches for her and eventually crosses the water to Britain, where he finds her and marries her. He then spends 7 years building castles and roads in Britain, so long that a usurper back in Rome takes his throne from him. The faint whisper of historical truth in this myth is that Magnus Maximus did in fact claim the title Emperor of Rome while still in Britain, and undoubtedly had spent a good portion of his time as a Roman commander, building roads and developing the Roman infrastructure on the island. Possibly Magnus Maximus also allowed tribes from the Western Island, modern Ireland, to settle on the western coast of Britain, a combination of cultures that produced the country of Wales. This would explain his appearance in Welsh tales of the country's origin, where he shows up so often that John Davies calls him a ubiquitous lurker. At this point, Britain had not yet been Christianized. The Roman army in Britannia was thoroughly committed to the old Roman state religion, discontented that both senior Roman emperors, Gratian and Theodosius, were Christian. Maximus, on the other hand, was unabashedly Roman in his beliefs. When the army acclaimed him, he announced his loyalty to Jupiter and then gathered up his forces and headed for Gaul, hoping to possess the throne of the West in fact, and not simply in name. An echo of this campaign appears in Geoffrey of Monmouth's thoroughly unreliable History of the Kings of Britain, in which King Arthur sails with his army to Gaul and fights against the Roman tribune who governs it. In that version of the tale, Arthur triumphs after laying waste to the countryside and sets up a royal court at the old Roman fortress town Lutetia Parisiorum on the Seine. In the real world, Magnus Maximus marched into Gaul and arrived at Lutetia Parisiorum, where Gratian met him in battle. Part of Gratian's army, the part that wanted an emperor who worshipped Jupiter rather than the Christian god, defected to Maximus's side, and the remainder were defeated. Gratian fled and died not long afterwards, either captured and killed by Maximus's soldiers or assassinated by one of his own officers. This left Maximus in control of Gaul, and he declared himself emperor of Gaul and Hispania as well as Britannia. The empire was divided into three: Magnus Maximus in the far west, Theodosius in the east, and Gratian's younger brother and former co-emperor, Valentinian II, still hanging on to power in Italy and North Africa. Now that he was in control of part of the western mainland, Maximus sent Theodosius an official message, emperor to emperor, suggesting that they be allies and friends. The invasion had happened too quickly for Theodosius to block it, and now that it was a fait accompli, he decided that it would be prudent to accept Maximus's offer. He and Maximus were old acquaintances, as it happened. They had fought together in Britannia as young men. He agreed to recognize Maximus as a legitimate emperor, and for 4 years, the three emperors ruled side by side, with Theodosius as the senior Augustus. Nevertheless, writes Zosimus, he was at the same time privately preparing for war, and endeavouring to deceive Maximus by every species of flattery. Preparing for war involved negotiating with the Persians. Theodosius didn't want to head west and immediately find his eastern border under attack. Ardashir II, the elderly brother of the great Shapur, had been deposed by the Persian nobleman at court after 4 years of inefficiency. Now Shapur's son, Shapur III, sat on the throne. The issue most likely to cause another war between the two empires was control of Armenia, so Theodosius sent an ambassador to Shapur III's court to negotiate a settlement. The ambassador was a Roman soldier named Stilicho, who had been born in the northern parts of the empire. His mother was Roman, but his father was a Vandal, a barbarian, a native of the Germanic peoples who lived just north of the Carpathian Mountains. Unlike the Goths, the Vandals were not a present trouble to the Roman Empire. Nevertheless, in the eyes of many Romans, Stilicho carried with him the taint of the barbarian. The historian Orosius, who disliked him, used his parentage to condemn him. He was sprung from the Vandals, an unwarlike, greedy, treacherous, and crafty race. But Theodosius trusted him, and in return Stilicho, at that time still in his 20s, performed an impressive negotiating feat. In 384, Shapur III agreed to divide the control of Armenia between the two empires. The western half of Armenia would be ruled by a Roman-supported king, the eastern half by a king loyal to Persia. Theodosius was grateful. When Stilicho returned, Theodosius promoted him to general and married him to the 14-year-old Princess Serena, Theodosius's own niece and adopted daughter. The treaty with the Persians allowed Theodosius to continue his preparations for war with the western usurper. Meanwhile, Magnus Maximus was making plans to move east against the court of Valentinian II. Maximus wanted to be true emperor of the West, and as long as Valentinian II was still in Italy, his legitimacy was shadowed. Valentinian II was only 15, and the real power in Italy was held by his generals and his mother, Justina. In 386, Justina gave Maximus the excuse he needed to invade Italy. She was herself an Arian Christian, which put her at odds with the Orthodox Bishop of Milan, Ambrose. They had quarrelled off and on for years. But in 386, Justina, by way of her son, issued an imperial order commanding Ambrose to hand over one of the churches of Milan to the Arians, so that they could have their own meeting place. Ambrose indignantly refused, upon which Justina upped her demands and asked for another, more central and more important church instead, the new Basilica. She sent officials to the Basilica on the Friday before Palm Sunday, the beginning of Holy Week, the most important week in the church calendar, while Ambrose was teaching a small group of converts in order to prepare them for baptism. The officials started to change the hangings in the church. Ambrose carried on, apparently ignoring them. The invasion of the church by imperial officials infuriated the Nicene Christians in Milan, and they gathered at the church to protest. The demonstrations spread. Holy Week was taken up with riots in the streets, armed arrests of citizens. The prisons were filled with tradesmen, Ambrose wrote to his sister later, and a larger turnout of imperial soldiers. Ambrose couldn't get out of the basilica because it was surrounded by soldiers, so he staged an involuntary sit-in with his congregants. He passed the time by preaching that the church could never be controlled by the emperor. The church was in the image of God. It was the body of Christ, and since Christ was fully God, a slap at the Arians, the church was itself one with the Father. Finally, Valentinian II intervened and ordered the soldiers out. But he was unhappy with Ambrose's power, even more than with the defeat of the Arian takeover. "You would deliver me up in chains if Ambrose bade you," he snapped at his court officials, and Ambrose was deeply afraid that the next thing coming down the pike would be an accusation of treason. When Maximus got wind of the unrest, he announced his plans to attack. The pretext, writes the church historian Sozomen, was that he desired to prevent the introduction of innovations in the ancient form of religion and ecclesiastical order. He was watching and intriguing for the imperial rule in such a way that it might appear as if he had acquired the Roman government by law and not by force. Considering that Maximus had originally campaigned in the name of Jupiter, his new pose as defender of the Nicene faith undoubtedly rang a little hollow. But this shows the extent to which Christianity, in the late Roman Empire, had already become the language not just of power, but of legitimacy. Maximus didn't merely want to be emperor. He wanted to be a real emperor, a lawful emperor, and in order to have any chance to assert this, he had to align himself with the Christian Church. Even while Ambrose preached that the Church was separate from the power of the emperor, the emperors wielded the Church as a weapon against each other. As Maximus marched across the Alps towards Milan, Theodosius marched west with his own army, and Valentinian II and Justina fled from Italy into Pannonia, taking with them Valentinian's sister Galla, and leaving Milan open to Maximus and his armies. When Theodosius arrived in Pannonia, Justina offered to give Theodosius her daughter Galla if he would drive Maximus out. Theodosius accepted. Galla was reputedly very beautiful. But in addition, the marriage related him, the rough ex-soldier from Britannia, to the Valentinian dynasty. He then marched the rest of the way to Milan, sending ahead of him plenty of information about the size and lethal skill of his army. Possibly Maximus had not expected Theodosius to actually leave the eastern border and come all the way west. In any case, by the time Theodosius reached Milan, Maximus's men were so thoroughly intimidated that his own soldiers took Maximus captive and handed him over. The war was resolved without a single battle. Theodosius executed Maximus, bringing an end to the reign of the first king of the Britons. He also sent an assassin, his trusted general, Arbogast, to find Maximus's son and heir. Arbogast found the young man in Trier and strangled him.
The whole invasion had worked out pretty well for Theodosius. He now had a whole new level of power over the West. He was Valentinian's brother-in-law and deliverer, and he staged a triumphal procession to Rome, in which he took center stage. He then departed, taking his beautiful young wife with him and leaving his general, Arbogast, now back from strangling Maximus's son, to be Valentinian's new right-hand man.
Like Stilicho, Arbogast was of barbarian descent. His father was a Frank, and so although he could pursue a shining career in the army, he had no hope of ascending to the imperial throne. Theodosius's most trusted aides tended to be half or more barbarian. They could not challenge their master for the throne. Arbogast was an experienced soldier by this time, and Valentinian II, accustomed to being dominated, was helpless against him. Arbogast took over the administration of the empire, reporting directly to Theodosius in the east, while Valentinian II sat in his imperial throne as little more than a figurehead. In essence, Theodosius now had control over the entire empire, and he turned his attention again to the project of unification. On his return to Constantinople, he began to issue the Theodosian Decrees, a set of laws designed to bring the whole Roman realm into line with Orthodox Christian practice. The first decree, issued in 389, was a strike at the very root of the relationship between the old Roman religion and the Roman state. Theodosius declared that the old Roman feast days, which had always been state holidays, would now be work days instead. Official holidays then, as now, were ways of laying out the mythical foundations of a nation, of pointing citizens towards the high points of the past that helped to define the present. Theodosius was not just Christianizing the empire, he was beginning to rewrite its history. In this, he was slightly out of step with the mood of the West. Back in Rome, the senators had already applied three times to the imperial court in Milan, asking that the traditional altar of victory, removed by Gratian, be reinstalled in the Senate. The appeals had been led by Quintus Aurelius Symmachus, the prefect, chief administrative officer of the city of Rome. He begged Valentinian to preserve the customs of the past. "We ask the restoration of that state of religion under which the Republic has so long prospered," he wrote. "Permit us, I beseech you, to transmit in our old age to our posterity what we ourselves received when boys. Great is the love of custom." But even more central to the argument of Symmachus was his understanding of faith. He could not see why it was necessary for the triumph of Christianity to do away with all reminders of the old Roman religion. His appeal continues, "Where shall we swear to observe your laws and statutes? By what sanction shall the deceitful mind be deterred from bearing false witness? All places indeed are full of God, nor is there any spot where the perjured can be safe. But it is of great efficacy in restraining crime to feel that we are in the presence of sacred things. That altar binds together the concord of all. That altar appeals to the faith of each man. Nor does anything give more weight to our decrees than that all our decisions are sanctioned, so to speak, by an oath. We look on the same stars. The heaven is common to us all. The same world surrounds us. What matters it by what arts each of us seeks for truth?" This was indeed the question, and Theodosius would have answered that as long as the citizens of the empire searched for truth by many means, They would have no single loyalty to hold them together. Already the division of the empire into two or three parts had sounded the death knell for any chance that the empire would be held together by any identity as Roman citizens. Already the Western Roman Empire and the Eastern Roman Empire had begun to assume different characters. Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan, opposed the applications. His answer to Symmachus laid out the exclusive theology that made Christianity so useful to the emperors. "What you are ignorant of, that we have learned by the voice of God. What you seek after by faint surmises, that we are assured of by the very wisdom and truth of God. Our customs, therefore, and yours do not agree. You ask the emperors to grant peace to your gods. We pray for peace for the emperors themselves from Christ. You worship the works of your own hands. We think it sacrilege that anything which can be made should be called God. A Christian emperor has learned to honor the altar of Christ alone. Let the voice of our emperor speak of Christ alone. Let him declare him only, whom in heart he believes, for the king's heart is in the hand of God." Ambrose was a hard and uncompromising man, but he understood what was at stake. The altar of Christ alone. It was the only hope for unification that Theodosius had left, and it was a powerful hope. Yet this power for unity was not without its complications for Theodosius. In 390, the year after the first of the Theodosian decrees was issued, he ran afoul of the church he was trying to make use of, and Ambrose excommunicated him, the first time that a monarch was ever punished by the Christian church for a political action. The action was a fairly straightforward, if cruel, act of retaliation. Over in Pannonia, a Roman governor had run into trouble at a tavern. Drinking late one night, he had shamefully exposed himself, and a charioteer sitting next to him at the bar had attempted an outrage. The routine drunken pass turned into an incident when the governor, embarrassed, arrested the charioteer and threw him in jail. Unfortunately, he was one of the most popular contestants in a chariot race to be run the next day, and when the governor refused to release him in time for him to compete, his fans rioted, stormed the governor's headquarters, and murdered him. Theodosius cracked down immediately and put to death everyone who had a hand in the riot, a purge that swept up a number of people who had simply been standing around watching. Ambrose was appalled by this injustice. When Theodosius next arrived in Milan to check on the affairs in the western part of his domain, Ambrose refused to allow him to enter the church either for prayer or for the celebration of the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper, the rite that separated believers from unbelievers. The Christian historians who recorded this merely say that Theodosius then confessed his sin, did penance, and was restored. But what passes almost as a footnote is the fact that it took Theodosius 8 months to do so. Standing on the steps and looking at Ambrose's unyielding face, Theodosius must have realized that his decrees were having an unintended consequence. The single Catholic Church held his empire together because it was greater than the state, greater than any national loyalty, greater than any single man. It was greater than the emperor. Theodosius's 8 months of reflection were 8 months in which, in all likelihood, the future of Christianity hung in the balance. Had Theodosius been able to think of any better strategy, he could simply have refused Ambrose's demands. But in doing so he would have had either to turn his back on the Eucharist, which would have condemned his soul, or to deny Ambrose's authority, which would have revealed that the Christian church was, in fact, not bigger than the emperor. Educated as he had been in the sacred oracles, concludes the Christian historian Theodoret, Theodosius knew clearly what belonged to priests and what to emperors. What belonged to emperors was not sufficient to hold the empire together. Theodosius finally went back to Milan, subjected himself to Ambrose's religious authority, accepted the several months of penance that Ambrose prescribed, and was readmitted to the fellowship of the church. He then ordered all Roman temples closed and abandoned so that Christians could knock them down and build Christian churches instead. He commanded that the fire once guarded by the Vestal Virgins in the Roman Forum be officially doused. He announced that the Olympic Games would be held one final time before their permanent cancellation. Finally, he announced that any act of worship made in honor of the old Roman gods would be an act of treachery against the emperor himself. The church might be greater than the emperor, but the emperor could still corral its loyalty and direct it to his own ends. Chapter 10. Cracked in Two. Between 392 and 396, the eastern and western halves of the empire find themselves in opposition.
In 392, after 4 years of Arbogast's help, Valentinian II killed himself in Milan. He was 21.
His death immediately lit the fuse of civil war. Valentinian's sister Galla, now Theodosius's wife, insisted that her brother could not have killed himself. Theodosius was obligated to investigate, and Arbogast realized that the emperor's first action would most likely be to remove him from power. Before Theodosius could act, Arbogast went to the Roman Senate and promised that he would help the senators restore the altar of victory and protect the Roman religion from extinction. Together, the senators and Arbogast chose a new Western emperor, a harmless and malleable Roman official named Eugenius, who was a Christian but inclined to be supportive of the rites of the old state religion.
Theodosius, receiving news of this action, refused to recognize Eugenius as a valid emperor. Instead, he named his own 8-year-old son Honorius to the Western throne. He then prepared for battle, hiring additional troops, federati, Gothic troops under the command of their own war leader, Alaric, to beef up his own army. He marched west with Stilicho, his general and son-in-law, and met the army of Eugenius, Arbogast, and the Roman senators at the Battle of the Frigidus, September 5th, 394.
Orosius insists that Theodosius gave the sign of the cross just before plunging into battle, and three different Christian historians record that a divine wind blew up and rammed the arrows of the Western army back into their own bodies. Authors note, the battlefield may have been blasted by a wind known as the Bora, formed when cold air is sucked into a low-pressure area over the Adriatic. Frederick Singleton notes that the Bora can gust up to 100 miles an hour, and can cause a rapid temperature drop of 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Sozomen adds that during the fight, a demon appeared at the church where Theodosius prayed just before the battle, taunting the Christian cause, and then fading away as Theodosius' army began to win the victory.
Stilicho and Alaric, leading two wings of the attack, were largely responsible for crushing the Western Roman army. Eugenius was killed that same day. Arbogast, seeing the destruction of his army, killed himself the next day.
It was, says Orosius, a battle of pious necessity. The accounts may not be terribly helpful in chronicling the exact progression of the Battle of the Frigidus, but the stories of divine winds and demons show that the historians knew what was at stake. This was more than another battle between competing emperors. It was a battle between two entirely different ways of understanding the world. When the battle ended, Theodosius controlled the entire empire, the East as senior emperor, the West as regent for his young son Honorius. It was the last time the Roman Empire would be united under a single ruler. Theodosius died in 395, the year after the battle. At his death, his two sons, from his first marriage, divided the rule as co-Augusti. Arcadius, 18, took the throne of Constantinople. Honorius inherited the West. As Honorius was only 10, Theodosius left instructions that Stilicho, the half-Vandal general, should act as his guardian. He also left his 5-year-old daughter, Placida, daughter of his second wife, the young and beautiful Galla, to be raised by Stilicho and his Roman wife, Serena. Stilicho, too barbarian to be emperor in name, was now emperor in practice. To the east, Arcadius, mild and easily intimidated, was ruling with the help of the army officer Rufinus. Rufinus was head of the emperor's personal guard, the highest military official in the east, and the final decision-maker in the empire. Like Stilicho, he held ultimate power. The whole empire being vested in Arcadius and Honorius, writes Zosimus, they indeed appeared by their title to possess the sovereign authority, although the universal administration of affairs was under Rufinus in the east and under Stilicho in the west. Unlike Stilicho, Rufinus had no barbarian blood. He could nurse the ambition of someday becoming emperor. Both sides of the empire were now threatened by a previous ally of Theodosius, Alaric, commander of the Gothic regiments at the Battle of the Frigidus. Alaric had hoped to become a regular Roman commander, Magister Militum, after Theodosius's death. Instead, neither emperor offered him this honor. Alaric blamed this, rightly, on his Gothic blood. His troops were already seething with discontent, a disproportionate number of Goths, over 10,000, had fallen at the Frigidus, and they suspected that they had been used as human shields for the regular regiments. Rather than continuing to struggle for Roman privilege, Alaric took control of his Gothic army and made himself its supreme commander and leader. In doing so, he managed to create a newborn nation and became its first ruler, King of the Visigoths. The historians of the late Roman Empire, Jordanes and Cassiodorus, most prominently, divided the Goths into two separate groups, the Ostrogoths, who lived to the east, and the Visigoths farther west. But these names didn't represent nations. They were simply a way to geographically distinguish between the Goths who lived on one side of the Dnieper and the Goths who lived on the other side. Before the time of Alaric, there was not really a Gothic nation. There was instead a shifting collection of Germanic tribes that sometimes fought together and sometimes against each other. Alaric's Gothic army was united, not because the soldiers belonged to a certain tribe, they all shared the same vaguely Germanic blood, but because they had drawn together into a cohesive military unit. When Alaric made himself their king, they became for the first time something more than an army. They became a self-constituted nation, united not by a single tribal heritage, but by a single purpose. This new confederacy took its name from the land where many of them had once lived, the Western Gothic land, but it included Visigoths, Goths from farther east, as well as members from other tribes farther north. Historians call this ethnogenesis, when a confederacy, united together by necessity or geography, makes itself into a nation by giving itself a name, a history, a royal lineage. Thanks to the outside pressure of Roman disdain, Alaric's Visigoths had become an independent people who now existed right in the middle of Roman land. They were resentful and hungry, and they had a strong leader with military experience, and so their first act as a nation was to raid the surrounding Roman provinces, taking what they thought they deserved and making a path towards Constantinople. The Eastern Emperor Arcadius and his general, puppet master Rufinus, were not well equipped to resist. Most of the Roman army was farther west, with Stilicho. Appealed to, Stilicho provided soldiers to head off Alaric, either because of the threat of a pitched battle or, more likely, because Stilicho carried on some behind-the-door negotiations with him, Alaric sloped off and instead started to ravage the countryside of Greece. The Roman soldiers then continued on to Constantinople. Apparently Stilicho had ordered them to go join the Eastern army as a favour to the Eastern Emperor Arcadius. When the troops reached the walls of the city, Arcadius came out to greet them, with the general Rufinus trailing behind him. The contemporary Roman poet Claudian records the events that followed. As Rufinus followed the emperor along the serried ranks of soldiers, the troops begin to extend their long lines behind his back and to join up the ends so as to form a circle unnoticed by Rufinus. The space in the center grows smaller, and the wings, meeting with serried shields, gradually form into one lessening circle. Then one more daring than the rest drew his sword and leapt forward from the crowd, and with fierce words and flashing eye rushed upon Rufinus. Straightway all pierce him with their spears and tear quivering limb from limb. They stamp on that face of greed, and while yet he lives pluck out his eyes. Others seize and carry off his severed arms. One cuts off the foot, another wrenches a shoulder from the torn sinews. One lays bare the ribs of the cleft spine, another his liver, his heart, his still panting lungs. There is not space enough to satisfy their anger, nor room to wreak their hate. The official story from the West was that the soldiers acted out of impulse, but Claudian insists that the Gothic soldiers who first stabbed Rufinus leapt forward crying, "It is the hand of Stilicho that smites you." He isn't alone in attributing the plan to Stilicho. Zosimus, who finds the men behind the throne unadmirable on both sides of the empire, in the respective cities, he complained, the money from all quarters flowed into the coffers of Rufinus and Stilicho, agrees that Stilicho ordered the assassination. If Stilicho did give the order, it was the first step in his attempt to extend his power over the entire empire. However, another courtier of the weak Arcadius immediately rose to fill the power vacuum, the eunuch Eutropius. According to Zosimus, Eutropius was no more admirable than the dead Rufinus. He was intoxicated with wealth and elevated in his own imagination above the clouds. and he was more dangerous than Rufinus, because he now knew his enemy. He recollected, Zosimus says, that Stilicho was master of everything in the West, and therefore he persuaded the emperor to convoke the Senate, and by a public decree to declare Stilicho an enemy to the empire. Eutropius was not emperor. He could not attack the Western power with armies. He had to use law instead. As he did so, he brought the duality of the Roman Empire into full view. The empire had held together under dual emperors and twin capitals, and it still existed as a single domain in name. But the crack that would divide it in two had become visible. Stilicho, guardian of the West, was now an outlaw in the East.
Chapter 11. The Sack of Rome. Between 396 and 410, the North African province rebels, the Emperor of the West retreats to Ravenna, and the Visigoths plunder Rome. For the Roman citizens on the North African coast, cross-currents in authority were nothing new. For centuries they had lived under the double authority of the distant emperor and of his local representative, the Roman provincial governor. North Africa was far from Rome. It was not uncommon for the governor to pay lip service to the emperor while doing the opposite of the emperor's orders. In 396, while Stilicho and Eutropius were jousting over control of the empire, a new bishop was appointed to watch over the Christian church in the busy coastal city of Hippo Regius. Augustine was a native African, born into Roman citizenship and trained at Roman schools in Carthage. His struggle to explain the nature of the divided authority he lived under would provide an imaginative picture of the world, so strong that the entire Christian church, and eventually the kings of the Western world, would grasp hold of it. In his 20s, Augustine had lived in Rome as a teacher of rhetoric. In his 30s, he lived in Milan, where the bishop Ambrose became his friend and advisor. For most of this time, Augustine was a Manichae, a follower of the religion established by the Persian prophet Mani more than a century before. Manichaeism taught that the universe was made up of two powerful forces, good and evil, which were eternally opposed, that matter was intrinsically evil, and that human beings could only return to the good by withdrawing from as much contact with matter as possible. After listening to Ambrose, though, Augustine rejected his Manichae past and, after some thought, decided to become a catechumen, a student of Nicene Christianity. His new training threw him into increasing uncertainty and distress. One day, as he sat in a garden in Milan, weeping over the misery in his soul, he heard a child's voice chanting, "Pick up and read, pick up and read." This he interpreted as a command to pick up St. Paul's epistle to the Romans, which lay nearby. When he read from it, he was instantly converted to belief in Christ. "A light of relief from all anxiety flooded into my heart," he wrote in his autobiography, The Confessions. "All the shadows of doubt were dispelled." He went back home and took up a career in the church. But the North African church to which he returned had been almost ripped apart by a dispute peculiar to it. Rather than arguing about the nature of Christ, the North African Christians were struggling with a question that had to do with the nature of his church. The dispute was rooted in the persecutions by Diocletian 100 years before. Diocletian had executed Christians all across the empire. But down in North Africa, the local Roman governor hadn't thrown himself behind the persecution. Instead, he told the local clergy that if Christians would just hand over their scriptures as a symbol of recantation, they could go about their business. Some did, others refused. When the persecution was over, the Christians who had turned down the governor's offer were incensed to find that one of the priests who had turned over his scriptures to the authorities was about to be made Bishop of Carthage. They insisted that any baptisms administered by this man would be a sham, and that his bishopric would contaminate the entire Christian church. The protesting North African Christians, who became known as Donatists, after their leader Donatus Magnus, believed that the church was a place where the grace of God was conveyed to believers through holy men. For the Donatists, baptisms were effective and Eucharists were real only when the priest who administered them was himself a holy man. "What perversity must it be," asked the Donatist leader Petilianus, "that he who is guilty through his own sins should make another free from guilt?" To this Augustine replied, "No man can make his neighbors free from sin because he is not God." His answer reflected the official position of the Bishop of Rome.
The church was a place where the grace of God was conveyed to believers because God willed it to be so, not because of the character of the men who occupied its official positions. The Donatists were the first Puritan Christians, the first to insist that the church was supposed to be a gathering of holy and righteous people, and that the unrighteous and unworthy should be purged from its midst. Against them, the Orthodox Catholic thinkers of the Church argued that it was impossible, and just plain wrong, for men to attempt to purify the Church of God. Augustine, forced by the Donatists to define the Church, wrote that the Church on earth would always be a mixed body, true believers and hypocrites temporarily united in a single group. "The Church declares itself to be at present both," he concluded, "and this because the good fish and the bad are for the time mixed up in the one net." It was not for man to separate the good and the bad. Only at the end of time, when Christ returned and all things were set right, would the frauds be winnowed out. This was not a minor problem. It was a major difference, and from the North African turmoil would eventually spring inquisitions and heresy trials and English Puritans. And although the question was a theological one, it was not unaffected by politics. In a time of chaos, when what it meant to be a Roman was increasingly unclear, the Donatists insisted on creating an identity they could control and a community that was thoroughly well-defined, without ambiguity, without uncertainty. The political chaos only worsened over the next years. In 397, the North African province revolted. The leader of the revolt was Gildo, the Comes Africae, the officer in charge of the defense of the Roman territory in North Africa. Since North Africa was part of the Western Roman Empire, it belonged under the control of the young emperor Honorius and his guardian Stilicho. But the eunuch Eutropius, Stilicho's enemy and the power behind the eastern throne of the young emperor Arcadius, had convinced Gildo to repudiate his loyalty to Honorius. "He annexed it instead to the empire of Arcadius," writes Zosimus, "and Stilicho was in extreme displeasure at this and knew not what course to pursue." The rebellion caused an immediate problem for Stilicho because the fertile fields of North Africa were the primary supplier of grain to the western part of the empire. Gildo's first move was to hold up the shipments of corn headed for Rome, which very quickly reduced the population of the city to hunger. In response, Stilicho convinced the Senate to declare a war against Gildo. 5,000 Roman soldiers, under the command of Gildo's own brother Mascazel, sailed to Africa to meet Gildo and his 70,000 men. Mascazel had more than Rome to avenge. Gildo had murdered his two sons, Gildo's own nephews. What could have been a bloodbath of Roman troops turned into a travesty. Mascazel, meeting one of Gildo's standard-bearers, slashed at the bearer's arm with his sword. The bearer dropped the standard, upon which all of Gildo's standard-bearers down the line assumed that surrender had been called, and lowered their standards as well. The soldiers behind them surrendered at once. Mascazel declared victory with barely a death on either side. Gildo tried to flee, but when his ship was shoved back to African shores by the wind, he killed himself. In declaring Stilicho an enemy of the East, Eutropius had won round one of the battle for power. Now Stilicho, reclaiming Africa for the West, had won round two. Eutropius's plot had failed, and this made him vulnerable. Soon he went the same way as his dead predecessor Rufinus. The Goth general Gainas arrived at the court of Constantinople with his army, demanded that the emperor put Eutropius to death, and then took his place as the third puppet master to control Arcadius. In less than a year, Gainas too lost his head, and another Goth soldier, named Fravitta, became Arcadius's consul and advisor. Then yet another crisis struck Stilicho and Honorius in the west. In 400, the Visigoth king Alaric, still leading his new nation, invaded the north of Italy. The Visigoths came not just with their fighting men, but also with their women and children. They intended to settle. Alaric had a nation. Now he was in search of a homeland. The Visigoth invasion forced Honorius and his court to flee from Milan and take refuge in the city of Ravenna. Ravenna was ringed with swampland and relatively easy to defend, but it was an impossible place from which to launch a fight against the Visigoths. The Western Roman Empire was entrenching and shrinking. For 2 years, the Visigoths spread across the north of Italy. Meanwhile, in the east, Arcadius had fathered a son, the future emperor Theodosius II. It had become the custom for emperors to appoint their infant sons as co-emperors. That way, if the father died, a crowned emperor was already in place to succeed. But Arcadius was afraid that declaring his son co-emperor would sign the child's death warrant. Should Arcadius die, and Arcadius knew just how precarious his hold on life was, no one would protect his son's power. Many would inevitably exploit the boy's isolation and make a bid for the empire, writes the Roman historian Procopius, and once they had attained it, they would easily usurp the throne and kill Theodosius II, who had no relative to be his guardian. He did not imagine that the divine Honorius would help, for things were now bad in Italy. Instead, Arcadius turned to the Persians. Persia had been at peace with the East since Stilicho's negotiations on behalf of Arcadius's father, 20 years earlier. The Persian king who had agreed to Stilicho's terms, Shapur III, had been succeeded by his younger son, Yazdegerd I. Yazdegerd, says Procopius, adopted and continued without interruption a policy of profound peace with the Romans. So marked was the friendship Yazdegerd offered that Arcadius, who trusted no one within his own empire, asked Yazdegerd to act as guardian to his baby son. Things were bad in Italy, Procopius had written, but they were about to get better. In 402, Stilicho managed to halt the Visigoth invasion. He met Alaric and his army on April 6th at the Battle of Palencia and defeated them. It was not an entirely honourable victory. April 6th fell on Easter weekend, and Alaric, barbarian though he may have been, was a Christian who assumed that Easter was a sacred holiday on which fighting was banned. Stilicho, ignoring the prohibition, drew up his troops and, according to the poet Claudian, exhorted them by shouting, "Win a victory now and restore Rome to her former glory. The frame of empire is tottering. Let your shoulders support it." The fighting that followed was bloody and costly for both sides, but it ended when Stilicho's soldiers stormed into Alaric's camp and captured his wife. The two men negotiated a treaty that returned Alaric's wife to her husband and gave northern Italy back to Stilicho. Alaric retreated back across the Alps, still without a homeland. But despite the victory in Italy, the empire continued to totter. Roman Britannia was in serious trouble. When Magnus Maximus had crossed over into Gaul to claim the throne, he had taken the best part of the Roman army with him, and for years afterwards the remaining soldiers battled desperately against the fierce peoples of Britain, invaders from the northern lands and from the sea. In 407, the remnants of the Roman army in Britannia, exasperated with the court politics in distant Ravenna, proclaimed one of their own generals emperor as Constantine III. Like Maximus, Constantine III wasn't happy merely to be emperor in Britannia, which was still the Siberia of the Roman Empire. He set out to conquer Gaul and Hispania as well. While Constantine III was heading eastward, Honorius made a sudden bid for independence. He was now 23, and presumably tired of having his life and his empire run for him by Stilicho. He had begun to hear rumours that Stilicho was planning a match between his own son and Honorius's sister, Placida. Raised by Stilicho and his wife after Theodosius's death, Placida was now 18. This sounded like a play for power. Stilicho might be resigned to never holding the title of emperor himself, but his son, with less Vandal blood and with a royal wife, might well ascend to the imperial throne. Honorius allowed himself to listen to the Roman officials at his court who accused Stilicho of planning treason. He arrested his former guardian, and on August 23rd, Stilicho, not yet 50 and with over 30 years of service to Rome behind him, was put to death at Ravenna. With his formidable old opponent dead, Alaric the Visigoth immediately came back from his wanderings in Central Europe and laid siege to the city of Rome. The Roman Senate tried to negotiate a peace, agreeing to pay him gold, silk, leather, and pepper if he would withdraw. Alaric took the ransom and withdrew, but he hadn't been merely seeking wealth. In 409, he sent a message to Honorius, threatening a second siege of Rome if Honorius didn't give him land in Illyricum for his Visigoths to settle on. Alaric was still in search of that elusive homeland. Author's note: Illyricum was the name for the larger area in which the provinces of Pannonia, Dacia, Thracia, and Macedonia lay, the modern countries of Austria, Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Serbia, Bulgaria, Macedonia, and Albania. Honorius refused, and Alaric fulfilled his threat, marching straight back to Rome. This time the siege dragged on a little longer, until Rome was hungry, exhausted, and beginning to suffer from plague. Alaric refused to leave, promising that he would see the city starve to death unless he was given a place to settle. No help came from Honorius, safely holed up in Ravenna. He had already received a message from the Roman soldiers left in Britannia, after Constantine III's departure, begging for relief, and had sent them back a curt order to cope on their own. He had no soldiers to send either to Britannia or to Rome. So the Roman Senate offered Alaric a deal. The Roman people would never accept Alaric as emperor, but the Senate would declare one of its own, the senior senator Attalus, to be emperor in place of Honorius. Alaric could then become his Magister Militum, his top military official. Like Stilicho before him, he would become ruler in all but name. To seal the deal, the Visigoths and the senators exchanged hostages, a strategy meant to ensure that each side kept its bargain for fear of its hostages losing their lives. One of the hostages sent by the Romans was a 14-year-old boy named Aetius, the son of a high Roman official. He would grow to adulthood among the Visigoths. Now, there were three emperors in the west, Honorius in Ravenna, Attalus in Rome, and Constantine III in Gaul. Not long after, a Roman official in Hispania declared himself to be an emperor as well. Any hope that Christian faith would bind the whole disintegrating mess together had entirely disappeared. Conquest was the only hope that any of the four emperors had of reunifying the Western Empire. Very soon, the cardboard emperor Attalus and his magister militum Alaric fell out with each other. When the Senate suggested putting a joint army of Visigoths and Romans under the command of a Visigoth officer, Attalus refused indignantly. He argued that putting a Visigoth commander in charge of Roman soldiers would be a disgrace. Incensed at this anti-barbarian sentiment, Alaric ordered Attalus to meet him at Ariminum, on the northeastern Italian coast. There, he took Attalus's purple robe and diadem away by force and imprisoned him in his own camp. Alaric then marched back to Rome. In August of 410, he arrived at the city's gates and forced his way in without difficulty. He was angry. He had been trying for years to get recognition from the traditional leaders of Rome, some sort of admission that his skill and his power compensated for his barbarian ancestry, but the recognition always receded away from him. In his bitterness, he told his soldiers that they could plunder the city, taking by force what they had not been given by right. The Visigoths broke into treasuries, stole coins and riches, and set fire to whatever took their fancy, although Alaric told them to spare the churches. Alaric himself took Placida, Honorius's sister, as his personal captive. The 410 incident became known as the Sack of Rome, even though it didn't destroy all that much of the city, and even though Rome had suffered much worse attacks. But for the far-flung citizens of the empire, both east and west, it served as a jolting revelation. The Eternal City, the Rome they had assumed would stand forever, was so diminished that a band of Visigoths could overrun it with almost no effort. No band of foreigners had entered the city for almost 8 centuries, not since 387 BC, when the city was not yet part of an empire. Jerome, the young secretary to the Bishop of Rome, was now a hermit in his 50s, living in the Eastern Empire near Bethlehem, and still working on his translation of the scriptures into Latin for the use of the West. "My voice sticks in my throat," he wrote later, recalling the dreadful news, "and sobs choke my utterance. The city which had taken the whole world was itself taken." In North Africa, Augustine too mourned, and in response to Rome's fall, he began to write his great work of history, The City of God. It was clear that Rome was no longer, if it had ever been, the Eternal City. It was merely an earthly kingdom that had served the purposes of God in its time, and its time was now past. But what of the Bishop of Rome? Did the city's fall mean that the Christian Church, too, would fade? It took Augustine 13 years to work out the answers. Once again he drew on the idea of double existence and dual authority. Rome, he wrote, was a city of man. And in all times, at all places, the cities of men exist side by side with the city of God, the true eternal city, the unseen spiritual kingdom. Men choose which city they will occupy, and although the goals of the two cities may occasionally intersect, and their citizens may find themselves able to cooperate with each other, the ultimate purpose of their citizens diverge. The city of man seeks power. The citizens of God's city seek only the worship and glory of God. Rome had fallen, but the city of God would endure forever. Chapter 12. One Nature versus Two. Between 408 and 431, The Persian emperor made himself unpopular by protecting the Eastern Roman throne, and a quarrel over theology reveals deeper divisions. The Eastern Roman emperor Arcadius had expected to die a violent death, but in the end, illness brought him down. He died of natural causes in 408, leaving the crown of the Eastern Empire to his 7-year-old son, Theodosius II. Thanks to the guardianship of the Persian king Yazdegerd I, Theodosius II ruled in peace. Yazdegerd took the job of preserving the little boy's power seriously. He provided an accomplished Persian tutor for the child. He sent the Eastern Senate a letter detailing his intentions to keep Theodosius II safe, and he threatened war on anyone who attacked the Eastern Empire. Yazdegerd reigned 21 years, the Eastern Roman historian Agathias tells us, during which time he never waged war against the Romans or harmed them in any other way, but his attitude was consistently peaceful and conciliatory. This attitude did him little good with his own people. The Persian noblemen at his court resented his peaceful policies. By extension, they also loathed his tolerance for Christianity within his domain. To them, Christianity was less a religion than a symbol of loyalty to the Romans. Yazdegerd earned praise from the Christian historians of the Roman Empire, but the Persians gave him the nickname Yazdegerd the Sinner, and he gets a universally black portrayal from Arab historians. The Muslim writer Al-Tabari says his subjects could only preserve themselves from his harshness and the affliction of his tyranny by holding fast to the good customs of the rulers before his period of power and to their noble characters. In other words, the Persians looked back with longing at the good old days when they had fought the Romans for dominance. They resisted Yazdegerd's policies and his decrees until he was driven to more and more drastic enforcement of his own orders. This only justified their bad opinion of him. His bad nature and violent temper made him consider minor lapses as great sins and petty slips as enormities, Al-Tabari writes censoriously. Finally, Yazdegerd buckled. When an overzealous Christian priest in Ctesiphon tried to burn down the great Zoroastrian temple there, Yazdegerd sanctioned a full-fledged persecution of the Persian Christians. This drove a wedge between Yazdegerd and the Eastern Roman court, particularly Theodosius II's sister Pulcheria, 2 years older than the emperor and a devout Christian. At 15, Pulcheria, already formidable, had talked the Roman Senate into naming her empress and co-ruler. In 420, when Pulcheria was 21 and Theodosius II was 19, she convinced him to declare war on his former guardian. Nor did the persecution do enough to mollify the Persian aristocracy. In 421, Yazdegerd died while travelling through Hyrcania, southeast of the Caspian Sea. The official story was that he had been struck by sudden illness, but an old Persian story suggests a more violent end. Yazdegerd was travelling when a spirit horse rose from a nearby stream, killed him, and then disappeared back into the water. The horse was the symbol of Persian nobility. Something undoubtedly was lying in wait for the king. The crown prince of Persia, raised by Yazdegerd to carry on his policies, was murdered by courtiers almost at once. The king's second son, Bahram, came from Arabia, where he had been exiled by his father, to be crowned Bahram V in his brother's place. Al-Tabari writes that when Bahram came into sight of the palace, Yazdegerd's former chancellor came out to greet him and was so awe-stricken at his handsomeness that he forgot to perform the ritual prostration with which Persians greeted their rulers. The story reflects the Persian belief in the Avesta, the divine aura of the appointed king, the royal glory that proved he had the right to hold power. Bahram's rule was legitimized, just as Theodosius's had been, by the will of the divine. Avoiding his father's mistakes, Bahram V carried on the persecution of Christians. He also mounted an aggressive defense against Theodosius II's declaration of war, assembling an army of 40,000 to march against the frontiers of the Eastern Roman Empire. It was a short war. Within a year, both Theodosius II and Bahram had decided it would be more prudent to swear a truce instead. Neither empire was dominant, and a war would be long and painful. Both sides agreed to refrain from building new frontier fortresses, and also to leave the Arab tribes on the edges of the desert alone. Each had been actively wooing the loyalty of the Arab tribes, Persia with offers of friendship, the Romans with Christian missionaries. When they had concluded this, Procopius sums up, each side attended to his own affairs. For Theodosius II, this meant getting married to a wife chosen by his sister Pulcheria. All three, brother, sister, and wife, lived together in the royal palace. Thanks to the Persian-enforced peace of his early years, Theodosius's court had now achieved the sort of stability that made the Eastern Roman realm capable of functioning like an actual empire, rather than like a military encampment whose generals were busy killing each other, the current state of the Western Empire. Theodosius now had the luxury of actually ruling, instead of just fighting for survival. In 429, he appointed a commission to synthesize all the irregular and competing laws in his part of the empire into a single coherent law code, the Codex Theodosianus. Author's note, it would be finished in 438 as the Codex Theodosianus, the basis for Justinian's law code, see chapter 28. He took credit for the new walls that now protected Constantinople, the Theodosian walls, and he founded a school in Constantinople for the study of law, Latin, Greek, medicine, philosophy, and other advanced subjects, a school that would eventually gain the name University of Constantinople, making it one of the oldest universities in Europe. The university was designed to take the place of the Roman University of Athens, the last remaining bastion of the old state religion. The intellectual center of the empire had begun to shift to the east, a movement bolstered by the relative peace of the east and the chaos in the west. Furthermore, in the University of Constantinople, there were a total of 13 chairs or faculty positions for teachers of Latin, and 15 for teachers of Greek, a small but significant gain in Greek language and philosophy over the Latin, which, thanks to Jerome's translation of the Bible, continued to be used in the western part of the empire. In 431, Theodosius also had to deal with another theological controversy, one that came to full blaze at the Council of Ephesus. Arianism, the doctrine that Christ was created by the Father rather than coexisting with him from eternity, was still alive, but it had been shoved away from the core of the empire, towards its edges. It was the religion of barbarians, a sign of incomplete assimilation to the Roman identity. But the matter of Christ's exact nature was